What I'm working on here is just that, you know, if I'm going to try to claim that there's such a thing as political spirituality, then I think maybe we ought to ask what we mean by spirituality. And then ask what we mean by political and see if the two connect. And, you know, if working for justice, if working through political channels brings some of this stuff, then we can begin to see where it happens and how it happens and identify it and label. We'd like to add one other thing here. And I've steered you in a certain direction by talking about spiritual experience. But I would like to add, in a little different direction, and this will be very important to what I have to say eventually. Whoops. The increase of spirit, or the increase of good. There is a sort of results dimension to it, if you will. There is the experiential dimension to it, but there's also that sense of increasing the sway of good over evil, extending, in traditional male language, extending the kingdom, extending God's dominion. There's a kind of struggle goes on. I mean, I think we've lost some of the tension of that. As a religious struggle, we recognize it as a political struggle or a moral struggle. You know, I mean, the Holocaust, the racism, we see it in those places. Those don't seem to us very often to be religious or spiritual kinds of struggles. But there's a kind of struggle always going on between the sway of good and the sway of evil, you know. To me, an important part of spirituality is increasing the arena of good. Making, again, sounds a bit heretical, but making God grow, making God bigger than God's sway currently is over affairs of human history. The specific topic that we're going to talk about a bit this morning has to do with stories of political activism. Did want to suggest one other exercise you might want to do sometime. Along the way, some of them we'll do and some of them I'll just suggest because of time constraints. Those of you that were here yesterday afternoon, we did a sort of meet the saints or meet an angel unaware as you met one another. Another way to do that is to do it in terms of groups, to talk about groups with whom you have had particular experiences that are give you a sense of connected, not only one-on-one, what we did yesterday is kind of one-on-one, but connectedness, awe, mystery, it's uplifting, brings clarity, calmness, integration, helpfulness, joy, awareness. Groups like what? Well, it can be a worship group. I was in a house church group for 5 years. We met every one night a week for 5 years. We also all went to our own separate churches. I mean, it wasn't a substitute for Sunday morning. But it was a supplement to that, where we found a real sense of connectedness and meaning. For some people, it's a family group. When I get together with my children, there is a sense of transcendent ecstasy and joy and shared and connectedness. My children range in age from 20 to 30, and so we go back 20 and 30 years together. And we've been through a lot of things together over those years. And so there is a sense of that group ecstasy and that group connectedness. I think for some people, it happens in 12-step groups. I don't know how familiar you all are with 12-step groups, but 12-step groups are the largest growing religious phenomenon in America today, I think without question. It's just an amazing phenomenon, and it had kind of gotten away from me. I was not that aware of it, and suddenly I became aware of it and realized that there are thousands, millions of Americans, and people around the globe for that matter. This thing is bigger than American or Christian. There are millions of people around the globe every week who get together in 12-step. Now, what's a 12-step group? It's like Alcoholics Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, and the group I was going to was not AA but Al-Anon. That is parents and friends of someone who has a drug or alcohol problem. I have a son who had a drug problem, has a drug problem. And so he went for treatment, and I started going to Al-Anon, a 12-step group, and discovered that some of those people go to meetings 2 and 3 times a week, 4 and 5. I know a person who goes every day to a 12-step group. I mean, that's like religious devotion. That really is. One of the women in the group that we were going to said that I thought there was no power outside of myself. And then I came to this group and I discovered a power larger than myself in the group. That is, I got strength from the group. I was saved from some of the things I was dealing with by the group. And once I discovered power in the group, I could acknowledge a higher power, a God. She said I was not very religious. I had lost touch with my religious rootage. But it was through that kind of direct existential contact in the group that there was this sense that, hey, I'm not in this alone. There are other people, you know, concerned about it, other people dealing with these problems. And these other people are supportive of one another. Yeah, it's probably more like the church was in its initial days, back before they had buildings and all those kind of things. But I think those are powerful identity groups. So there are groups, whether family, friends, church, 12-step, or whatever they may be, maybe work groups, with whom we participate in social settings that bring us those kinds of sense of meaning, those kinds of experience. They are, I would say, spirituality groups, even though we may not think of it as a spirituality group. And so the exercise you could do with a group of people is to have them sit in twos or threes and share and talk about some group that they participate in or have participated in that brings them this sense of meaning and satisfaction and so forth. Another exercise that we could do, or do it rather quickly, is one called the Saints of Social Justice. I asked you yesterday to meet one another as saints, to discover one another as angels unaware. But there are certain saints, instead of dividing up into twos or threes, let's just do this because we're small enough, we can do this as a whole group. Who are some of the saints of social justice for you, and why? Who are some of the saints of social justice? Either people you have known, could be a grandmother, or people you've read about, Martin Luther King Jr. Who are some of the saints of social justice, and what is it about them that has inspired you or made you feel that they are really important in this kind of way?
Ruth Youngdale Nelson.
Okay, why?
Older woman who would take a stand and be willing to go out on peace issues, Greenpeace, and say what she believed. Even
okay.
If it meant jail.
She's gone to jail, yes, huh?
She's been arrested, but I don't know if she's gone to jail.
Yeah, she's been arrested. That's scary.
Yeah.
That's very scary.
But it's really something you believe that
I've always
much.
Managed to avoid that.
Are you on the list?
Am I on the list? Don't know. I've never had the courage to ask. Honestly, I hate to. If you ask for your file, for your federal file, then they make a note that you ask for your federal file, and they wonder why you want to know.
Then they start you on.
Then they start one. That's right. I hunch that probably at some level I am, but I don't know. I've never had the courage to ask. I'm basically, as I said, just basically a coward. When somebody said they thought that what I had said sounded courageous, I was kind of, whoa, you know. You see something I don't see, that's great. I like the sound of that. I'll own that.
Paul Bull.
Who?
Paul Bull.
B-O-E?
Mm-hmm. Paul Bull. He was interim director here Bull, a couple of years ago.
Why?
Okay, we're from South Dakota.
Uh-huh.
And back in the, let's see, about 71 or 2, there was a new wounded knee confrontation between federal authorities and and the AIM, American Indian Movement.
Uh-huh.
And Paul Bull was really a confidant of some of the leaders in the AIM.
He's a Lutheran pastor.
Yeah, I've heard of him, I've not met him.
Yeah. Well, he passed away very suddenly, had a heart attack here about, well, this is spring. But the leaders of AIM confided in him. And on the basis of, you know, confidentiality, clergy confidentiality, he refused to give testimony and was facing a jail sentence. And it was a very interesting experience because we had a service in support of Paul Bull at First Lutheran Church in Sioux Falls.
Mm-hmm.
And we did not know that morning, even until that noon.
We marched down to the courthouse with him where he had to.
Whether he would then have to surrender to federal authorities and be taken away to jail,
wow.
Or whether there would be a stay.
Yeah.
I think is what. But the whole issue of clergy confidentiality. Was at stake here. It was a larger issue than Paul Bull. Uh-huh. We all knew it.
Mm-hmm.
But he was willing to face this, and it was an interesting service in a variety of ways. Among them, that at the worship, you had whites and you had American Indians, mm-hmm. And that's not a real common phenomenon. Mm-hmm. In
sure.
Many parts of the country, including sure. South Dakota, especially mm-hmm. South Dakota.
Mm-hmm. So he was the same because he took a stand, and because also I gather there was a sort of interracial dimension to it that was important to you. Interracial, interethnic.
There was an element, I think, of maybe a little bit of reconciliation going on here, trust building.
I mean, I'm changing your words, but I'm trying to catch a sense of their meaning. I'm not trying to steer you into some category of mine. She was sort of culture transcended what is expected in a white culture and was able to bridge and reach across and so forth.
It was not without controversy, incidentally,
mm-hmm.
in the community and in the church.
So there was a certain bravery or courage?
Very much so.
Well, I would say courage, especially on the part of Paul Bull.
Yeah.
The rest of us weren't facing jail sentences.
Yeah.
We might get some criticism, but
yeah,
you
sure.
can live with that.
Yeah, yeah, well, you're a parish pastor, you do live with it. Or you get out. That's inevitable, it's part of the game. Comes right there with the laundry. Okay.
Suffragettes.
Why?
Well, they believed that women should have the same consideration as males, and a lot of them went to jail for their stands, chained themselves to the White House fence. And
uh-huh. Took a stand on issues, possibly went to, I'm not going to just, you know, the things we've already said, I mean, I'll just repeat them all, but they had a vision of equality, they had a belief that something had. It worked. I mean, this is a big deal here, I think. They just hunkered down and worked for 50 years. I mean, that's kind of mind-boggling, you know. Say, well, for the next 50 years, we're going to work on getting about 50 years. Oh, give me a break, you know. I've maybe got, you know, one day a week for the next 3 months, but give me a break.
Yeah, it was longer than that, too, when you look back to England.
Yeah, however long it was. I don't know exactly how long. They worked endlessly or tirelessly. I'm sure they got tired.
There's a lot of social pressure to stop and for their families.
Social pressure.
Ostracism.
Susan B. Anthony would go to the polls, even though she wasn't allowed to vote, and she'd get a ballot and try and vote, and they'd arrest her and haul her off to jail to try and make her sing and so forth. I was utterly thrilled. I preached, I have one good sermon. One really good sermon. I get invited to supply preaching, so I just preach that sermon a whole bunch of different places. I mean, why preach bad sermons if you can preach a good sermon? And it's about Hagar and Sarah and Hagar's child and so forth. And it's a feminist oriented sermon. And I preached it in August in a church in the D.C. area. And I was utterly thrilled when, and I didn't say the word feminism, I didn't say the word suffrage, but nonetheless, you know, the sense of it was real clear. And this woman comes out, and she is like, you know, kind of small and all bent over, you know, and she comes out, and she comes up, and she shakes my hand, she said, and she smiles, she says, I was a suffragette. Wow. I can't believe this. It's wonderful. She got it. She got the message. I didn't have to say the exact word, but she got it. Some of those folks are still around. It's not so very long ago, 1921. I mean...
Yeah. Well, it's still going on today, all the, you know, people, women and men who are still struggling.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Other people or... groups that have inspired you to, that you've admired. It's interesting, those are people that you've known and people that you haven't known. I mean, but they can be inspiring. You look as though you have one you're about to say.
Well,
it's sort of forming on your lips, I can see it.
I had two people we were thinking of. One was Mother Teresa.
Uh-huh, sure. I guess so, my Nobel Prize. Because?
Concern for the poor.
Yeah, kind of infinite compassion. And the other was?
A personal friend, E.O. Gilbertson, those are his initials. He's now dead. He was the district president of our old church and took a great deal of criticism because he was in the Paul Bull March and he took many stands for Indian rights, which is not very popular in South Dakota. When Paul Reed was killed in the civil rights.
Paul Reed?
Reed, down in, where was he killed, in Georgia?
Selma.
Selma, Alabama, yeah.
R-E-E-B. R-E, you said E-E-B?
E-E-B. We had a big march in down the street and for civil rights. And Dr. Gilbertson was one of the leaders in it, which took a great deal of strength to do.
Yeah, read a book. It's been, I think, New York Times bestseller list. So it's very well written, one Pulitzer Prize. I think Pulitzer is Parting the Waters. Parting the Waters. Big size, 800 pages, but fairly good size print. It's not a tiny print. by Taylor Branch. I think they have it over here in the bookstore. Yeah, because I bought it over here when I was here in June, as a matter of fact. Because I had heard about it, Parting the Waters, subtitled America During the King Years. It's sort of the story of Martin Luther King Jr., but it's not just the story of Martin Luther King Jr., and it's not just a, you know, a biography that praises one person. I lived through that era. It was the civil rights movement that got me into this stuff in the first place. I was a parish pastor in Maine. And the 60s, early 60s, I got out of seminary in 62, early, the civil rights movement was tooling along, and I got caught up in that stuff, and that's the whole rest of my life, in terms of focus, have been around those kinds of things. But it's about not just King, but it's about all those people. I mean, I really was amazed. I knew there were sit-ins, and I knew there were bus rides. I really didn't have really any grasp at all of the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kids down to elementary school age who got out there and sat in and went to jail. That's scary. That's scary to me. I've been in jails, but never to visit people. I don't like jails very well. And I managed to keep myself out of them in terms of social justice activity. But here are these hundreds and hundreds of kids, hundreds and hundreds of college students, hundreds and hundreds of local folks who were basically pretty disempowered. You know, they were the gardener and the this and the that and the other thing. They weren't, by and large, leading citizens in the community. They weren't, by and large, all that terribly well-educated or whatnot, and yet, putting it on the line week after week after week, it's an amazing story. It's just an amazing story of the courage of ordinary people, Paul, and others like him, that you're mentioning here, reminds me of the many people, some who died, some who lived. Anybody else you want to?
Well, it reminds me of, I don't know his name, call him X.
Sure.
But he just came to my door, and he was at Greenpeace, and it was just storming outside, just typical Seattle day in the winter. And he was collecting for Greenpeace, but it was more than just here's my box, put some money in it. It was a real desire to talk about the issues. And this man was active. I mean, he was active at a very grassroots level. And I think there's a lot of X's out there. You prompted me with your talk.
There are a lot of people. One of my favorite stories, a bunch, but is at a meeting, Shreveport, Louisiana, ends at 9:00. I'm supposed to go ahead to Ruston, spend the night with a woman whom I've never met, because it's my first time in this area. Or first time, no, it was actually I've been through, but I hadn't met her for some reason or other. And so I call ahead and say, look, it's going to be 11:00, 11:30 when I get there, but I'll get there as fast as I can. My meeting straggle on. I don't know what time I got out there, but anyhow, by the time I got to her house, she gave me directions on how to get there and said I'll leave a light on in the back. Name's Hazel Meadows. And so I drive through the dark, and I'm pretty exhausted. We sleep in members' homes to save money and also to get to know our members better, so that it's a personal thing. It's not just meeting people at meetings, but it's really getting to know the home, the lifestyle, the kids, the spouse, the family setting, so forth. And so I finally get there, and I'm exhausted. Sure enough, I pull up, and there's this light on, and I'm hoping I'm at the right house because it's kind of late, and I get out of my car, and get my bag in, my hanging bag, and my other suitcase. And you're tramping up to the side door, and all, I knock on the door. And this woman comes to the door, and she's got to be in her 80s. And she comes to the door, and because she knows I was bred for the world, she's never met me before, I'm a total stranger. I mean, I could be a murderer, or I could be anything, you know. She just opens the door, invites me in, shows me up to a room, you know, with a four-poster bed, and a few mints and a little dish on the side, and a flower in a vase. And just takes me in, and, you know, just her trust, her openness to take in this total stranger. I used to take in people when I lived in Texas. They'd come in for peace events. And, you know, I'd have a whole family sleeping in this room, and I'd have somebody on the sofa and somebody back there. And you don't know these people. I mean, you don't know them at all. I never see most of them again. I don't even know their names. You know, they come and they go. But that sense of trust, that sense of openness, that sense of common bonds, of sharing something together. Turns out Hazel Meadows is a matriarch of her Methodist church. I went to her women's meeting, and it's Ms. Hazel this and Ms. Hazel that. And it turns out that she has a grandson who's an aide on Capitol Hill, an aide to a member of Congress. So when Hazel comes into D.C., she always calls up. When she comes in to visit her grandson, she always calls up. And though my stereotype was, well, here's this nice, sweet person. In fact, in the morning, she launches into this discussion over issues that leaves me kind of reeling. I'm saying, well, yeah, I think that what that means is, and you know, she's really tacked into this stuff. She knows what's going on. She knows those issues, working on them. Saints of social justice that I run into on a day-to-day basis working with Bread for the World, and there are frustrations of working with Bread for the World, and there are joys. But the primary joy is that I work with the saints of social justice every day of the week. And that is an incredible kind of thing. People who take you in, people who say, well, there was one family in Texas, they aren't all that active, but they put me up for a night at the beginning of a trip, and then I was coming back at the end of the trip, and they said, well, we're going to be off to a wedding somewhere else, and you may get home before we do, so here's where we keep the key. And I'm thinking, whoa, I don't know if I really want to know this, you know, because if somebody would steal something, and then they'd say, oh yeah, we showed the key to that guy. So anyhow, I get back to the house around 10 o'clock, 10:30, get the key, open the door, go in, go up to the room where I had slept before, do the things I need to do. It comes 11, 11:30, they're not home. I go to bed. I get up at 6 o'clock the next morning because I've got to return a rental car and catch a flight out of town. I hear them come in. They're there, but I never see them. I leave at 6 o'clock. I go down, you know, get a banana or something like that, out the front door, spend the night in their house and never see them, you know. But there's this sense that, hey, this is okay, you know. We're sharing together in this kind of stuff. We could go on at great length identifying saints of social justice. And like the spirituality thing, we can add others later. When I was, tell you another story and then invite you perhaps to share some stories. See, to me, let me give some of the meaning of some of this. This is not just Johnny Carson anecdotes, okay? The word faith, the word hope, the word love, trust. Faith is a kind of trust. It's always been a little bit numinous. To have faith in God has always seemed just a little bit numinous to me. But
what is numinous?
Well, a little bit elusive. A little hard to get my hands on. I mean, how do I have faith in God? I sort of project some feelings and some imagination somewhere. That's always been a little hard to get hold of for me. But I know that Hazel Meadows trusts me. And I know that Bread for the World members trust me and I trust them. And that's very real. And that's very tangible. It's very clear. And that to me, that is a spiritual connection. It's not just a story. It's a story about faith, hope, and love. It's a story about real connections, existential connections with people that are also spiritual connections. When I was teaching in seminary, I had this class called Strategies for Change, and had a really quite extraordinary group of people in the early 70s once. And what this class did was, it was a sort of learn by doing, that you actually got out there and got involved. How do you learn about how to get involved? Well, you jump in. And you jump in the middle, and you don't know what you're doing, and you thrash around, and you gradually figure out how to do what you're doing. And especially if you have somebody around who's done it before. But anyhow, we decided that we would try to bring some changes to the city jail. There had been something in the newspaper about jail reform, and so we did some research and discovered that there were no toilet tissue in the jail, because the inmates in the jail were taking the rolls of toilet paper and stuffing them in the toilet and then flushing the toilet and flooding the jail. So they had no toilet tissue, they had no blankets, they had no mattresses, so they were sleeping on concrete floors and metal bunks. There was no judge on the weekend. So that, say you're just a regular citizen and you get arrested for, I don't know, not having your driver's license or something. Or say, you know, you have strayed over a line and you're arrested for drunken driving, say. What you are is, you are thrown in jail for the weekend with murderers and rapists and whatever else happens to be in there, because there's no judge to make a discrimination between one kind of thing and another. And I'm not trying to minimize drunken driving, that's a very serious problem. But there is, if you're in a jail cell, there is some difference between somebody who's killed somebody and somebody who may have been slightly over the line on drunken driving, or who just didn't have their driver's license, or had too many outstanding tickets and never got around to paying them, say, and was perfectly sober or whatever, and still nonetheless winds up in jail. So we decided that we would try to do something about this jail situation. So we formed a citizens group. And it's fun, you know, when you think about it. You can go out, this group right here could form a citizens group and call ourselves anything we want and present ourselves to be anything we wanted to present ourselves to be. I mean, to me that was kind of a mind-boggling thought. We called ourselves, we had a lot of fun, we were working on names and acronyms and what should we call ourselves. We decided to call ourselves POR. We were for the poor, P-O-R-E. People opposed to repressive enforcement was what we called ourselves. And we also learned that at the jail they had a cold, greasy egg sandwich for breakfast that was cooked about 20 miles down the road, about 2 or 3 hours earlier. That there was what they called the goat farm, which was where they dried out alcoholics. And one of the jobs those people did was cook these egg sandwiches early in the morning, and then somebody would put them in a van or something and haul them into the jail. So we went to this church on a Sunday night. First, on a Sunday night, we got a reporter there. And the reporter had a microphone. It wasn't connected to anything. And he'd come up to us at TV stations. The next day we were going to do a demonstration. And he was getting us ready to deal with the media. So while he was walking around with his microphone, kind of role-playing us and getting us prepared, some of the other folks cooked egg sandwiches. That night we cooked, 10 or 12 dozen egg sandwiches. You know, you just cook them in fat, lots of fat, and you dump them in between two pieces of white bread and nothing else, you know, and you just wrap them, you know, so that you can deal with them. And then some of the students made a sandwich board, that is to say, no, like this, just a couple of pieces of cardboard on the front and the back, and he put sandwiches on each quarter of the board and all that kind of thing. We had made arrangements. City Council met on Monday morning, and we had made an appointment, we had asked to get on the agenda, but they didn't know who we were. It just said, poor, you know, what's 10 minutes on the agenda. I had in that group the urban minister from Fort Worth. I had a couple of therapists, a couple of pastoral care people. One of the pastoral care people used his counseling skills, his group work skills, to manipulate city council. taking the group skills and using them on city council. He did a kind of act of jujitsu. He got one of the city council's people to get angry, and then the newspapers carried this story about the stupid things the city council member said, see? And it made us look good and all that kind of stuff. So it comes Monday morning, and we're all kind of nervous and all that kind of stuff, and we go out there, and we've got these egg sandwiches, and we're handing them out to members of the press and to the city council and to the local bums, you know, bums, that's not a good word, sorry, street people, to the local street people as they come by, you know, and local citizens, and some people take them, and some people don't know what's going on, you know, and all that. And they come by, and they interview us, and they say, who are you? You know, where did you come from? We're poor. We're the people opposed to repressive reform. We're a bunch of seminary students, a seminary faculty member, an urban minister, and a couple of counselors. But, you know, what does anybody know? Be whatever you want to be. So we did all this. Meanwhile, our counselor goes into the city council meeting and does his little number in there. The TV cameras are on, all that kind of stuff, and the reporters are all there. And so then that, and I have a faculty meeting at 9 o'clock. So I leave the group at 9 o'clock. They're going fine. They're marching around the city hall and all that kind of stuff. And I go off to a faculty meeting. I'm thinking, oh my gosh. And I said at the beginning of the faculty meeting, I said something about it, about what was going on. And none of the people at the seminary knew that this was happening. And that was the other reason we'd given ourselves a name, Poor, because we wanted to disassociate ourselves from the seminary and from the university. We didn't feel the seminary and the university should have to take any heat over this. We could just be an anonymous group and that would work okay. So anyhow, I mentioned at the beginning of the faculty meeting, and the dean later described that. He later used to say he was glad he was wearing brown pants those days, that day. Because when he heard about it, he said he about, yeah. We did all that kind of thing. And then that night, you know, in the evening news, you know, they show marches and signs and sandwiches and all that kind of stuff. We handed out brochures, you know, if you want to work with us, join us in our work, you know, against inhuman jail conditions and all that kind of stuff. Well, somebody picked up one of the brochures and called the number. The number was a student apartment. And this guy showed up at our next meeting. Well, the next meeting was in a seminary classroom, you know. And it happened that the urban minister got there late that day. He was taking the class for credit and all that, but nonetheless, his full-time job was urban minister. And as he walked into the room, he saw this guy sitting at the back, who none of us really knew, and he greeted him by name. And about 3 minutes later, that guy got up and left. He was a city undercover police agent. But we didn't know that. He was trying to infiltrate us and see who this group was and see what all this trouble was about and so forth. Well, there it's on the evening news. Well, it turns out that there's a lot of good people in Fort Worth, Texas think that those jail conditions are pretty bad. And so the newspaper wrote an editorial saying, we don't know who these people are, these poor people, but we think they're right, and we think there ought to be jail reform, and we think that there ought to be mattresses and blankets. And the city council appointed a study commission in response to it, and there was a lot of publicity about the member of council who made a fool in public in statements. And so what we did was then, once they appointed a subcommittee, we started negotiating behind the scenes and dealing with that subcommittee and working on them. And sure enough, about a month later, and even the city jailer came out and interviewed. The head jailer said, yeah, you know, it really is bad in here. Turned out the police were on our side. The police didn't like the jail. They didn't like to have to bring people in there. It turned out that all these people were on our side. The newspaper, the TV and radio stations, the jailer. And we sort of expected them all to dump on us. I mean, when you go into something like that, you really expect to take some heat. But these people all thought it was wonderful. And city council struggled, and sure enough, they passed an ordinance. They provided mattresses, blankets, a judge on Saturday morning, separate jailing for alcohol and other kinds of people in for other kinds of issues. We wanted the alcohol people out of jail altogether, but we wanted them in some kind of detox center. We saw it more as an illness than as a criminal kind of offense. unless there was a, you know, a major accident or something like that. They provided the rules, the jail rules in Spanish and English. I mean, if you were a visitor, you'd go in there and you didn't know what to do or where to go or anything. What else? I think that was it.
About breakfast.
Breakfast, yeah. They started providing them with hot meals, breakfast, and lunch. And now, that was a really fun, I mean, we had fun. We were scared, but we had fun. It wasn't like the thing you're talking about, the AIM thing, which was pretty scary from all the stuff I read about, people with guns, and, you know, this was very, very different than that kind of event, you know. But we had this experience of community with one another. We had a great time together. We would talk about this later. It was a great experience we had had together, and we actually did something. We actually, now, it's partly luck, it's partly serendipity, you know, that when something happens positive. 2-3 years later, I'm picking up the newspaper and I'm reading that the mattresses have worn out and the city council, on its own, has bought new mattresses without any further citizen input. You know, 8 years later, they built a new jail so that they wouldn't be jamming people in so tightly. 12 years later, the new jail was full. Had to start going around again. I visited someone in that jail. I went to get someone out of jail once. And I went in, and there were the rules, Spanish and English, posted right there in the wall. And I thought, all these people that have gone through here and have benefited from this, none of them heard of me. They've not heard of these students. They don't know anything about us. All I know is that things are a certain way. But the reason things are that way is because some people got out there and hustled and did what they thought was right. Now, most of the activism I'm involved in these days is not like that at all. It's more letter writing and phone calls and grassroots political activism. I was, Monday night, I was with some folks in Portland, and we're planning an event in Portland in February, the first weekend in February, major event. We're going to bring some staff in from D.C. on a Friday night and Saturday. And then on Wednesday, I was with some folks in Gig Harbor. And on Sunday and Monday of that same week, we're going to do some events in the Seattle or Des Moines area. Tuesday night, I was at a candidate forum in Salem, where Mike Kopetsky is running against Denny Smith. Denny Smith has been a very regressive member of Congress. He won the election last time in a recount by 700 and some votes. 700 and some votes. I have a woman friend who's an attorney and was a judge and is running again, who won an election by 12 votes in a recount. And you're talking out of thousands and thousands of votes. Does my vote count? Well, you know, yeah. As a matter of fact, it does. As a matter of fact, it does. Doesn't seem like it. But as a matter of fact, it does. Do those phone calls make a difference? Sometimes they do. Do those letters make a difference? Sometimes they do. How many people do you suppose in the state of Washington are going to sit down this week and write, well, this week, Congress probably is adjourned by now. They were supposed to adjourn Saturday. I don't know whether they did or not. How many people do you think in the state of Washington are going to sit down and write their member of Congress about third world debt? None. Zero. Five letters from a congressional district. 10 letters from a congressional district is an avalanche of letters on a topic like that. And we'll talk more about that if some of you are here still Monday. Talk more about what we can do and how we can do it and so forth. But so there are all kinds of activism. There's the activism of marching and demonstrating and you know, did some of that back with Jesse Jackson when he was getting started in Operation Breadbasket back in Chicago in the 60s. But then there's also the quiet long-term activism of putting people up for the night, Hazel Meadows, of knowing the issues, of writing letters, of the wearying job of meeting with people and calling meetings and people don't come and you try again and you try again. That's activism too, and that does and can make a difference. Some of you may have some short stories you'd like to share about activist things you have done. At any level, it can be anything that you feel has made some kind of contribution. It can be a Sunday school class that all of a sudden some people turned around and said, whoa, you know, I never thought about it that way before. Or it's not just the dramatic stuff that counts. The dramatic stuff counts, but that's not just what counts by any good means. Anybody?
In Nebraska, when I was going to college, they had a bill on the unicameral floor that was going to create a student minimum wage, and it'd be less than the minimum wage is now. And we heard about it, and of course we were very upset because a lot of people count on that income to put themselves to school. And a lot of them have families, and there, I mean, it was a really dumb bill because it didn't differentiate between anybody. So we went, and I got some people together. We got about 12 people to go to the unicameral that day. And if we hadn't have been there, there would have been no one speaking on the side of the student. And it was just, it would really upset me because these small businessmen would come in because they saw that as a way to make more money for them. Uh-huh. And they didn't realize the effect, I don't think, of what it would, be very devastating to some people financially to be able to put themselves through school. And it was just kind of neat because we got up, we made the Omaha World Herald, we made the Lincoln Journal, we made a lot of the local school papers, and it was just neat because a lot of these people had never even thought about it before, so I was really pleased because it was just a small group, and if we hadn't been there, I don't think it would have passed anyway, but the idea that it got some publicity and people to realize, it was neat.
Yeah. Hard to measure cause and effect in these things. You know, would it have passed anyway? It's real hard to know on cause and effect.
I don't think it would have, but because it was so, the way it was written, it was just horrible, the whole concept of it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you never know. I mean,
that's right. That's right.
You just never know. I mean,
that's right.
And the sad thing is, on a college campus, only a small percentage of people realize the effect that it would have. There was a time that Nebraska is probably one of the most poorly funded states to higher education, so I'm a real big advocate of funding for education. And a few people took the initiative and we got together a petition. We had within 24 hours, we had 800 signatures on it. But we got all four state colleges to go down there because they were going to cut funding for the state colleges and to build a new football stadium. This is idiotic. But and they were even considering closing one down. So we, all four schools took the day off and went down to Unicameral and just overwhelmed these people because they had no, I mean, students, I mean, sure, a lot of them didn't realize they were just going down because it was a day off, but when you get a whole school to get together, busloads of people to go into this one building, and it was really overwhelming, and I think it changed a lot of the senators' attitudes towards it because they don't realize that it's not just the universities that need the funding, and those regional schools are really important to reach those outposts where a lot of a whole lot of people live, but to those people who need those services, and it was really neat.
That's great. Member of Congress gets elected, or of state, or city council. What is their first goal? Their first goal is to get reelected. If you can, you know, they are subject to a certain amount of influence.
It's really sad, but I think the whole political system is set up that way because I think a lot of people go in with the notion that they want to do something positive, that they want to make a difference, but the whole system is almost detrimental to that because they have to consider well, I've got to, in order to get into office, I've got to have these votes, and in order to get those votes, I might have to compromise my feelings or my beliefs in one way or another, and maybe lessen the impact of what really should be done in this state.
Yeah. It's a very, very, very messy system. Remember, a lot of people worked in Chicago to get this progressive person on the city council, Mayor Daley's Chicago, back in the late 60s. And, well, there's Mayor Daley now, but I mean the Richard the King, King Richard. And this guy got in as alderman, and then the machine came to him and said, well, you know, if you want funds for projects in your precinct, then you're going to have to deal with us. And you can choose. You can have your nice, you know, righteous stands, or you can have good things for people in your district. And he went right down the tubes just about that fast. Maybe for good reasons. But it's a mess. The political system is a mess.
I get a lot upset with people who, in this meeting, you know, the subject, but people who put down politicians.
Yeah.
And they say they're all crooks. And I don't know, I just turn around and I look at them and I say, well, at least they're trying. I said, what have you done in this last year? And these people sit back and they go, oh, I never thought of it.
There are some extraordinarily good people in there. But even the good people have to make trade-offs.
Yeah, we do, and it's a shame that that's the way life is. So if you can make it work, you can almost use the system to your advantage. Yeah. It's just a matter of knowing how to do it.
Anybody else want to share a story before we break?
Well, I and three other women tried to organize a union at a small paper that we worked at.
Wow. That's a tough go.
I was really naive going into it. I learned a lot about myself and felt a lot of connectedness with the other women, and it was hard. And we failed, you know, to get the union, and we succeeded in other ways, but went on for 2 years.
Wow.
Before they finally broke us, they hired a union busting lawyer from Chicago to come in, and when we thought it, you know, would be like a fair fight, and, you know, we just
do
their side and they do their side and then everybody votes.
That's right. That's right. Everybody gets together and has a nice, reasonable discussion and you win.
Yeah. But they were like ripping down our signs for the meetings and sending spies to the meetings. And
wow.
One of the women we thought was on our side, we finally figured out she was snitching on us, you know, and telling them all our tactics. So.
Okay. Success is hard to measure, real hard to measure. It's like education or ministry. Now, sometimes when I don't feel like gearing up for something, I remind myself that somebody sitting in that group, that Sunday school class, may be a senator someday. You never quite know. You never quite know where it's going to reach. So you fail to organize the union, and maybe it was a total failure. Probably wasn't. Maybe you learned some things. Maybe somebody's life is a little different because of it, and because their life is a little different, something else happens, and the thing kind of spreads itself out. It's real hard to, especially the big stuff. When you get to the level of the National Congress, it's really hard to have that sense that I did X and as a result Y happened, you know. And yet, I think that hope, one of the meanings of the word hope, is not just crossing your fingers about something that, well, I hope so. But hope is hanging in there when you know that it's the long haul. 5 years, 20 years, 100 years. When will we have settled the problem of racism in American society? I've hoped by the year 2050. I hope. I just say 100 years, 2060. Figure 100 years from the civil rights movement, 2070. Somewhere in there, there is at least, I think, some possibility. You know, to me, hope is not just a numinous crossing your fingers or whistling in the dark. But hope is hanging on to that vision that things can be other than they are. Really can be other than they are. That we do not have to have, that the next millennium does not have to have as much mindless cruelty, victimization, unneeded death as this century. This has been the most, I think, the most violent century in human history. Incredibly violent century. We think we've made a lot of progress. We have made a little progress.
But how can you set a time? I mean, like, time is neutral. It reminds me of Martin Luther King in the Birmingham jail, you know, when the ministers wrote.
Yeah.
The other clergy wrote and said, now isn't the time.
Right.
And he said, there is never a right time. And, right. and nothing, things aren't going to change just with time. It's that people have to work to make them change. And I'm wondering, are you seeing that's going to happen, or
that people are working to make change?
Yeah, so things will be different by, you know, within 100 years. Or, mm-hmm. I mean, I see it going backwards as far as like civil rights or racism.
Things go,
Bush,
sure.
Kind of that attitude that we can ignore all that. It's not important.
Sure. Things do go backwards for long periods. I mean, you have the Civil War, the slaves are freed, and then you have Reconstruction it takes another 100 years after the Civil War before you get another major bunch of impetus, you know, to create the Civil Rights Movement of the 60s. And people were working all that time. Yeah, we are not in a good time for social justice people. We're not in a good time. This is the poll that you read about in the paper last week or 2 weeks ago, that college students are, in the period that this poll has been going on, are more self-interested and less interested in other people and justice than at any time since this poll has been done. We're not in a good time. We're not in a good time. But I continue to hope, because I see around me people who continue to do, some full-time, some part-time. I mean, it's just amazing to me sometimes. We have an intern at Bread for the World who showed up this fall. This guy's name is Paul Chan. He's a graduate of Harvard, just graduated from Harvard. He's Asian originally, but lived in this country for a long time, since he's a little kid. Paul shows up and he's doing a year of internship at Bread for the World on no money, no stipend. Now, we found him free housing and food. Turned out he wasn't eating lunches because he didn't have lunch money. Now the family he's staying with provides him with a bag lunch or a can of tuna fish or an apple or something like that, and he now has lunches. There are the Paul Chans of the world, whether Asian of origin, Anglo, Black, Hispanic, who continue to believe and who continue to work, who continue to have hope, and who just down there in the trenches and keep slugging it out. And yeah, I do believe that things can be different. I have to believe that things can be different.
I was wondering why you set that year.
100 years? Oh, that's arbitrary. That's a really kind of metaphor for saying people think the problem's solved now, and I want them to stretch their minds a little bit and say, whoa, we're a long way from home. It's just a kind of metaphor. It's
well,
not
to
really
me, that seems short. Short.
100 years? Yeah. Oh, well, you think I'm being overly optimistic, huh? Pollyanna-ish.
Well, no. Yeah, unless you see a big movement toward people really getting interested in these issues and really working hard. And I was just wondering if you saw that.
In civil rights, no.
Yeah.
Racism sort of resurfaced in American society with the things that are going. I've gone in Boston and New York, so forth. The Tawana Bradley case. In D.C., it's been very much on our minds because with Mayor Marion Barry, what do you do with a mayor who's a civil rights person, who's been a civil rights activist, has a reputation, has done lots of good things, and then gets arrested for sniffing cocaine? And has there's some evidence he's had widespread drug use and a lot of sort of playing around, which, while not illegal, is not exactly something you'd choose in a mayor or anybody for that matter. So that's brought the whole racism thing sharply into question in D.C. Do you defend him because he's black? Would you defend him if he were white? If you attack him and you're black or you're white, if you're white and you attack him, are you being racist? It's been a very touchy and thorny issue in D.C., and a lot of white people just walked around saying nothing. So there is some resurgence of that stuff that we're having to deal with. No, I don't see any great movement for civil rights.
But, do you see it as resurgence, or it was always there?
Oh, it's always there. It's just more visible.
It's more acceptable
now
to express.
It's become more acceptable. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When David Duke can run for the U.S. Senate, against J. Bennett Johnson in Louisiana, and stand a chance of winning. I mean, that's scary as all get out. That's scary as all get out. Yeah. But what alternative do you have? You know, faithfulness says you have no alternative. There's really no alternative. Win, lose, or draw. Even if you don't win, there's no alternative but to hang in. So, well, I don't really talk. I just preach. any setting, any content, I just preach. We'll take a break, and I think that there's another session. If some of you are interested, at 11 o'clock, we'll continue this conversation. And then again tomorrow morning at some time or other. I think there's probably coffee. I don't know if they have, is there a snack break at 10 at this time? Snack break. Okay, so there's not only coffee, but if you want, there's some kind of something up there. So probably some of those good muffins from breakfast that are left.
Yeah, that's about it.
Hey, that's worth walking up there for.